issues. If you are living in a mansion, I am not too sure how would you understand the difficulties and issues people facing on the street.
I think it's going to be even more, to be honest. If nothing's going to change, it's going to get worse. Yeah, because the young generation is growing as well. They're struggling to get jobs. They're struggling to get a property or to afford to rent. It's going to get worse, yeah.
Well, it's not sending a good image, if you ask me, but I think the whole world is the same, really. It's not just Britain, but I think it's going to get better. Let's just hope it gets better.
I think I had my time. Perhaps the next generation is going to be getting even tougher time. So, in one hand, government is borrowing billions and hundreds of billions of pounds. Nobody knows where it's going. But the next generation has to pay. And perhaps, sadly, the homeless people will be the last one to be in the queue to get the help.
Mr. John Sparks, the chief executive of Homeless Charity Crisis, has said, "You cannot free people from the cycle of homelessness without a proper home and, crucially, the support they need to keep it long-term." Amnesty International adds that frontline services warn they are at breaking point due to a rise in homelessness, and that the UK could be facing a human rights catastrophe. At the same time, when it comes to housing difficulties, black households are particularly at risk.
As the UK experiences yet another rise in COVID-19, and as Boris Johnson appears focused on his own survival, his government struggles to solve the homelessness issue. The Prime Minister could himself be evicted from Downing Street. Yet his problems are small compared to being homeless or sleeping rough day after day, while the government's COVID crisis has made it even less able to help one of the most vulnerable groups in the country, people with nowhere to live.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. It has not been uncommon in recent years to hear Americans worry about the advent of a new civil war. Is civil war ahead? The New Yorker asked last month. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times opinion columnist Jamelle Bouie. The piece is titled, Why We Are Not Facing the Prospect of a Second Civil War, and has been published in the opinion section of the New York Times. Stay with us for more. It has not been uncommon in recent years to hear Americans worry about the advent of a new civil war. Is civil war ahead? The New Yorker asked last month. Is America heading to civil war or secession? CNN wondered on the anniversary of the 6th of January attack on the Capitol. Last week, Representative Adam Kinzinger of Illinois told The View that we have to recognize the possibility of a civil war. I don't think it's too far of a bridge to think that's a possibility, he said. This isn't just the media or the political class, it's public opinion as well. In a 2019 survey for the Georgetown Institute of Politics, the average respondent said that the United States was two-thirds of the way towards the edge of a civil war. In a recent opinion poll conducted by the Institute of Politics at Harvard University, 35% of voting-age Americans under the age of 30 placed the odds of a second civil war at 50% or higher. And in a result that says something about the divisions at hand, 52% of Donald Trump voters and 41% of Joe Biden voters said that they at least somewhat agree that it's time to split the country, with either red or blue states leaving the Union and forming their own country, according to a survey conducted by the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia, where I am a visiting scholar. Several related forces are fueling this anxiety, from deepening partisan polarization and our winner-take-all politics to our sharp division across lines of identity, culture, and geography. There is the fact that this country is saturated with guns, as well as the reality that many Americans fear demographic change to the point that they're willing to do pretty much anything to stop it. There is also the issue of Donald Trump, his strongest supporters and their effort to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Americans feel farther apart than at any point in recent memory, and as a result, many Americans fear the prospect of organized political violence well beyond what we saw on 6th of January 2021. There is, however, a serious problem with this narrative. The civil war we fought in the 19th century was not sparked by division qua division. White Americans had been divided over slavery for 50 years, before the crisis that led to war in 1861. The Missouri Crisis of 1820, the Nullification Crisis of 1832, the conflict over the 1846 war with Mexico, and the Compromise of 1850 all reflect the degree to which American politics rested on a sectional divide over the future of the slave system. What made the 1850s different was the extent to which that division threatened the political economy of slavery. At the start of the decade, the historian Matthew Karp writes, in This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy, slaveholding power and slaveholding confidence seemed at their zenith, the result of spiking global demand for cotton and the dependence of the entire industrial world on a commodity that only American slaves could produce with profit. But with power came backlash. Over the course of the decade, Karp notes, slavery was prohibited in the Pacific states, came under attack in Kansas, and appeared unable to attach itself to any of the great open spaces of the New Southwest. The growth of an avowedly anti-slavery public in the North wasn't just a challenge to the political influence of the slaveholding South. It also threatened to undermine the slave economy itself, and thus the economic basis for Southern power. Plantation agriculture rapidly exhausted the soil. The sectional balance of Congress aside, planters needed new land to grow the cotton that secured their influence on the national and international stage. As Karp explains, slaveholders in the 1850s seldom passed up an opportunity to sketch the inexorable syllogism of King Cotton. The American South produced nearly all of the world's usable raw cotton. This cotton fueled the industrial development of the North Atlantic. Therefore, the advanced economies of France, the Northern United States, and Great Britain were ruled in effect by Southern planters. The backlash to slavery, the effort to restrain its growth and contain its spread, was an existential threat to the Southern elite. It was the realization of that threat with the election of Abraham Lincoln, whose Republican Party was founded to stop the spread of slavery and who inherited a federal state with the power to do so, that pushed Southern elites to gamble their future on secession. They would leave the Union and attempt to forge a slave empire on their own. The point of this compact history with regard to the present is that it is irresponsible to talk about civil war as a function of polarization or division or rival ideologies. If those things matter, and they do, it is in how they both reflect and shape the objective interests of the people and factions in dispute. Which is to say that if you're worried about a second civil war, the question to ask isn't whether people hate each other. They always have, and we tend to grossly exaggerate the extent of this country's political and cultural unity over time. But whether that hate results from the irreconcilable social and economic interests of opposing groups within the society. If it must be one way or the other, then you might have a conflict on your hands. That's where America was with slavery. That's why our actual civil war has been called the impending crisis. I'm not sure there's anything in American society right now that plays the same role that the conflict over slavery did. Whatever our current challenges, whatever our current divisions, I do not think the United States is where it was in 1860. We have enough problems ahead of us already without having to worry about war breaking out here.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Turkish prosecutor has requested to hold the trial for Jamal Khashoggi's murder in Istanbul and transfer it to Saudi Arabia,
some 4 years after the dissident Saudi journalist was murdered in Turkey. The court requested the Justice Ministry's opinion on the issue and is expected to rule on the request at its next hearing, set for April 7th. The Saudi Chief Public Prosecutor's Office had requested the transfer, and evidently the Turkish courts are planning to comply. Turkey's justice minister said earlier that his ministry would approve a request to transfer a trial over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi to Saudi Arabia. Human rights groups have condemned the move, saying Riyadh cannot be expected to hold a fair trial for the alleged killers of the journalist. In 2020, Saudi Arabia jailed 8 people for between 7 and 20 years for Khashoggi's murder. None of the defendants was named in what rights groups described as a sham trial. Back in 2018, Jamal Khashoggi, a journalist and critic of the Saudi government, was murdered after he entered Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed how a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalist inside the diplomatic mission. A U.S. intelligence report released a year ago said Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, had approved the operation to kill Khashoggi. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said the murder had been ordered at the highest levels of the Saudi government, an accusation that has already strained the relations between the two countries and led to an unofficial Saudi boycott of Turkish goods, which cut Ankara's exports to Riyadh by 90%. The request by the Turkish prosecutor comes as Turkey seeks to mend ties with Saudi Arabia.
The Saudis absolutely have both an economic and a political interest in further ties to Turkey and Erdogan. I think it is a relationship where both of them are looking to get out of their tough situations, both politically and economically. There is political devastation and economic devastation, specifically in Turkey, and there is an economic, clear economic interest to Prince Salman of Saudi Arabia and various other figures in both Saudi Arabia and Turkey to increase these ties that are beneficial for the United States and for other Western vassal states in the Middle East.
Turkish-Saudi relations have remained strained since Khashoggi's murder and dismemberment in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. With the announcement that Turkish courts will no longer seek to hold Khashoggi's murderers accountable, it seems clear that Erdogan has decided to prioritize his political future over the pursuit of justice in the Khashoggi killing. In recent months, Erdogan has spoken of improving ties with Saudi Arabia, hoping that better relations will help Turkey recover from an economic crisis that has left it struggling with 50% inflation. He apparently is hoping to attract financial support and investment from Saudi Arabia as well as the UAE for Turkey's inflation-ravaged economy. Turkish and Emirati leaders recently visited each other's capitals, ending a decade of hostility culminating in Abu Dhabi's announcement that it intended to make $10 billion in new investments in Turkey. In addition to his efforts to improve ties with the Saudis and Emiratis, Erdogan has also looked to improve relations with Israel. The recent visit to Ankara by Israeli President Isaac Herzog signals a reset in Erdogan's stance.
Turkey is trying to view a new balance of power in the Middle East and in relations with all the countries around them. Turkey has always, when it comes to global geopolitics, tried to play both sides. They've been on both sides where they have economic ties in Russia, economic ties and political ties to the United States. And in the Middle East, there has always been a complicated nature of Turkey's relationship to Islamist groups throughout the Middle East, and that entire situation has showed that Turkey doesn't maybe necessarily want to be in the middle ground any longer. And it seems that in this era of rising tensions and changing relations, Erdogan and Turkey is trying to position themselves in a possible place where Western ties and economic benefits shift the balance of power in the region.
Given the emerging degree of cooperation between Israel, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and the US, Erdogan's recent efforts to pursue closer ties with each of these countries may reflect not only his interest in winning foreign investment, but his strategic calculation about the future balance of power in the region.
Over a month ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced what he called a special military operation to, quote, demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. The West, which had been warning Russia against such a move, resorted to providing aid to Kiev and decided not to join the war. It, however, used a different type of warfare, the economic one.
We're coming together to reduce Europe's dependence on Russian energy. Putin has issued Russia's energy resources to coerce and manipulate its neighbors. That's how he's used it. He's used the profits to drive his war machine. And that's why earlier this month I announced the United States would ban all imports of Russian energy.
The United States and its allies imposed several rounds of sanctions on Russia, mainly targeting its energy and banking sectors. The decision is drawing criticism, including from among U.S. lawmakers. Thomas Massey, a Republican representative for Kentucky in the U.S. House, says no treaty can supersede the U.S. Congress in determining when America should go to war. He explains that the often cited Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which states that an attack on one member state will be met with a collective response, isn't binding. That's because Article 11 of the same treaty stipulates that the provisions of the pact must be carried out according to the constitutions of the respective member states.
The United States is putting its country and its citizens in a psychological and economic war against Russia. It's a war against Russia in every sense but a direct military conflict. And there's a very thin line, and we're very near crossing that line to direct military conflict. So what this guy is saying is a correct warning to the American people. We cannot let ourselves be pushed into war by default and by some kind of automatic mechanism that sidesteps what would be the constitutional and legal and political requirements that if we're going to go to war with the country, we have to have a congressional resolution for it.
Besides, as several officials and experts have been warning, cutting off a major country from the global supply chain will expose the whole world to risks that could snowball into a catastrophe of epic proportions. As the US takes aim at Russia, it leaves itself vulnerable to the possible ricochet. U.S. House Representative Thomas Massey agrees, saying the Western sanctions on Russia haven't been thought through. Massey says American farmers who are being cut off from Russia's fertilizers will be hit hard. But that's not all. Russia and Ukraine account for about a quarter of the world's wheat production combined. A prolonged conflict and sanctions on Russia will take a toll on the world's food supply, potentially exposing hundreds of millions to hunger around the world. The price of the sanctions is also being paid at the pumps, especially in the West, with fuel prices soaring to new highs, pushing up the inflation rate in countries like the UK to figures not seen in decades. Numerous academic studies have been conducted on the effectiveness of economic sanctions. They all indicate that the punitive measures do little other than hurt the ordinary citizens.
Sanctions are going to hurt Russia, and they're going to hurt everybody, you know? And Russia has learned to live with sanctions and got along okay, and maybe even better. They've learned to replace some of the things they depended upon. So whatever damage is going to be done to Russia, there is going to be equal or greater damage done to the other side of the sanctions.
Why insist on entering a game that won't have any real winners? Is inflicting pain on a rival worth taking equally, if not more painful, punches?
Afghanistan has suffered crisis after crisis over the past decades, but the situation has perhaps never been so grave. Afghan people now have to live with the terrible mess left after so many years of war. There is no doubt that most of the problems facing the South Asian nation have their roots in war. The United States and its Western allies have been widely criticized for their 20-year military campaign, which wreaked havoc in the country but failed to achieve its stated goals. Afghanistan is now at a critical point. It has turned into a historic test for the international community. This week, top diplomats from Afghanistan's neighboring countries gathered in China for their third conference on the situation. They seem to understand better than other countries what is at stake if Afghanistan fails completely. The foreign ministers of neighboring countries called on the Taliban to adopt further measures to improve living conditions and guarantee the basic rights of all Afghans, including women and ethnic minorities. The foreign ministers also renewed their call on the Taliban to form an inclusive government.
And I think that there's potential significance in it if they can manage to produce the aid. And not only money aid, but if they can organize food shipments and fuel shipments and this sort of thing into Afghanistan and pressure for equitable distribution where it's necessary, then of course this conference could save Afghanistan.
Iran, which is hosting several million Afghan refugees, said during the conference that neighboring and friendly countries should strengthen cooperation in the reconstruction of Afghanistan and boost assistance to its people without political considerations. At the conference in China, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian proposed a security mechanism to coordinate counterterrorism policies by the neighbors. He also stressed that the root cause of problems in Afghanistan is the long-term occupation and misguided policies of the occupiers, mainly the United States. Afghanistan is grappling with an endless list of problems months after the chaotic withdrawal of the United States. The story of Afghanistan today is unending suffering for its people. Poverty and hunger have worsened nationwide. According to the World Food Program, 95% of Afghans do not have enough food to eat. Many millions of Afghan children face life-threatening levels of hunger. Meanwhile, outbreaks of deadly diseases among children are rife as the Afghan population cannot access adequate health care and routine vaccinations. On Thursday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres once again raised the alarm about the situation.
Without immediate action, we face a starvation and malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. People are already selling their children and their body parts in order to feed their families. Afghanistan's economy has effectively collapsed. There is very little cash. More than 80% of the population are in debt.
Afghanistan has been reliant on foreign financial aid for a very long time. But the need for financial resources has never been so serious. Afghanistan's massive humanitarian crisis has its roots in foreign restrictions on its banking sector. U.S. sanctions on the Taliban have left international banks wary of allowing aid groups to transfer funds into the country. Meanwhile, the U.S. decision to keep billions of dollars in frozen Afghan funds held in the U.S. is being blamed for a large part of the crisis. Calls have been growing on the United States to immediately release the sum it seized from Afghanistan's central bank, causing a devastating hunger crisis. All eyes are on the U.S. now to see if it realizes the need to change course and move in line with those who are truly concerned about the situation in Afghanistan.
The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge have concluded week-long tour of the Caribbean. The trip was to mark the Queen's Platinum Jubilee this year and saw William and Catherine also visit Jamaica and Bahamas. But the tour was marred by a series of gaffes and protests by local people over the visit.
As the tour progressed, it became increasingly clear that a trip intended to show the royals as empathetic and in touch was sparking the totally opposite reaction.
The trip of the British royals to the Caribbean and Central America reflects the broader colonial relationship that the United Kingdom has had with the region. Countries like Jamaica, Trinidad, Belize, Barbados, so many others, Guyana in the region, that have been colonized and enslaved by British bankers, by a British royal family for centuries.
When William and Kate greeted cheering children by a football pitch who were standing behind a wire fence, the resulting imagery created a deeply uncomfortable look for the monarchy. And when they deliberately recreated the Queen and Prince Philip's journey on a Land Rover from decades ago, the wistful nod to a bygone era struck an odd tone in a country looking to move forward, not back. Earlier in the tour, William was forced to tackle Britain's historic role in the slave trade, expressing his sorrow that it ever happened. The move came following anti-colonial protests in Jamaica and Belize, but William fell short of a full apology. Jamaican President Andrew Holness said they will push for the island to be a republic with a referendum this year. Protesters outside the British High Commission in Jamaica handed over a letter signed by a group of 100 prominent individuals from Jamaica's Advocates Network calling for an apology and recognition of the need for atonement and reparations.
And so what the peoples of the Caribbean and also other places colonized by England are demanding is reparations. I think this is exactly what they mean by atonement, by paying for the sins of colonization and imperialism. We know that Barbados, Haiti, and so many other Caribbean countries, the sugar that was produced in those nations in the 1800s was worth millions today.
The United Kingdom has a dark colonial past in many different places of the world, including the Caribbean. The UK institutionalized a slave trade between the Caribbean, Africa, and London, stealing the wealth of its colonies to enrich itself. London, Bristol, and Liverpool, which were hubs of the slave trade, became wealthy and powerful. Britain formally abolished the slave trade in 1807, but only outlawed the slavery in 1834, after the Slavery Abolition Act was passed by the Parliament the year before.
And actually, millions of dollars of wealth from the Caribbean in sugar, in tobacco, in alcohol was extracted during the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, up until the 1900s, when many of these nations won independence from the crown.
The British government paid the slave traders £20 million in compensation, 40% of its budget. That is some £17 billion. The government took out a loan to pay it, which was only paid off by British taxpayer money in 2015. That means the British government, using public money, paid slave owners, but not those who were enslaved. Britain's colonial past and its treatment of former colonies and the residents have raised harsh criticism.
And England and the Crown in particular are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth, in order to maximize their profits. And what the Crown represents is exactly this.
The Commonwealth Nations, which was created after the first half of the 20th century, after decolonization of the British Empire, is a dark reminiscent of British past. And now calls are growing to abolish the institution.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com. www.iribenglishradio.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Forty moral tips for the challenging journey to God, selected from statements made by the leader of the revolution. The first and foremost step in self-edification is that one should look at themselves and their behavior and manners with a critical eye. They should clearly and carefully observe their shortcomings and try to correct them. This can be done by us, and this responsibility is upon us. Between you and God, one of the most important characteristics in self-edification, and probably the first priority, is sincerity. It means being sincere in doing something and not acting deceitfully. Sincerity in worshiping God and doing good deeds means doing it only for the sake of God. It is unfortunately common among people to talk about their good deeds as if they are not aware that good deeds should not be bragged about. There are, of course, exceptions. Some deeds should be done publicly. For example, donating in public is valued differently in hadith than donating secretly. Another example is congregational prayers, which are done in public, and it is part of the divine orders. But many or most prayers, those between an individual and God, such as reciting, remembering God in dhikr prayers, spending nights in praying and helping others, should stay between the individual and God.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Be our own therapist. Be your own therapist. The best one to distinguish our shortcomings is us. Write them down: jealousy, stinginess, malevolence. Write down that when someone achieves something, it upsets us. Write about your sluggishness when working. Write about your pessimism about good and righteous people, negligence of responsibilities, egocentricity. We are so self-absorbed. The month of Ramadan is a great opportunity to treat these maladies as much as possible. You will become of steely if, in the first place, a young student should engage in self-edification, build their characters through religious training. Education, educators, and educational speakers are all needed. But if there is not an inner mentor to train and educate you, such training will not be effective. Build your characters and fight your ego. Value obeying God's commands in your personal lives and engage in prayer, attention to God, and relying on God. This will make you as strong as steel.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Exactly 1 week before the first round of the French election, the embodiment of the past 5 years marched in Paris. Yellow vests who were crippled, blinded, and mutilated by police. On every Saturday from November 2018 until June 2019, a national bloodletting took place on a scope which was unprecedented in recent Western history. The numbers are as staggering as the lack of Western condemnation for the French government. At least 11,000 arrests, 1,000 imprisoned, 5,000 protesters seriously hurt, 1,000 critically injured, scores maimed for life, and 11 deaths. Those who suffered the most say they don't want to be forgotten when voters go to the ballot box.
When you're mutilated by the police, there's naturally a lot of suffering and a lot of complications to our daily lives. But we keep our head held up high to show what Mr. Macron has done to his own people.
The huge phalanx of armed police, which still accompany the yellow vests every Saturday, kept their distance, while the mainstream media was not present at the protest almost at all.
It is the average citizens who supports us, because we do not even exist to this state or to the justice system. Where there is no police brutality and there are no victims, then how can we exist?
Over 75% of cases involving hurt protesters are immediately dropped without any court case or even an investigation. Punishment of police for mistreating yellow vest anti-government protesters has been almost non-existent.
By denying that there was any police brutality, the government legitimized it. How can we have confidence in a government which cripples its own citizens or in institutions which do not intervene to stop that? It is truly barbaric violence which chose to mutilate people simply because they believe in a better future.
The yellow vests are routinely credited with an approval rating of 75%, an unheard-of score in a country where perceptions of political corruption are commonplace. The state-sponsored police brutality, combined with the so-called anti-yellow vest laws, scared many into no longer attending public protests. President Emmanuel Macron is expected to win a close re-election, but the damage to France's international reputation cannot be estimated. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
It was a day of high drama and surprises in Pakistan. The country's parliament was to vote on a no-trust move against Prime Minister Khan, but the deputy speaker blocked the vote by ruling that the opposition's move was part of an international conspiracy against the government.
No foreign power has the right to topple the elected government through a conspiracy. The points raised by the law minister are valid, therefore I disallow and dismiss the vote of no confidence move.
Within minutes, Prime Minister Khan appeared on national television and dissolved the parliament.
President Sahib ko.
After the ruling of the speaker, I have advised the president to dissolve the assemblies. And in democratic society, change must come through elections. People, not the foreign powers, should decide who they want in power.
Khan claims he was being ousted from power by the US for pursuing independent foreign policy. But opposition parties have rejected the move and termed it a violation of the constitution.
Banana Republic.
The government has tried to show that Pakistan is a banana republic. Pakistan is a growing democracy, and we will not allow anyone to violate the constitution.
Khan came to power in 2018 and promised to bring reforms in the country. Opposition accused him for failing to deliver on his promise and hence wanted to seek his ouster. But the speaker's move to reject opposition's vote of no confidence has triggered a constitutional crisis in the country.
The focus has now shifted from the parliament to the Supreme Court of Pakistan. The country's highest court will decide whether the speaker's ruling and subsequent decision by the prime minister to dissolve the parliament is constitutional or not. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
As the sun sets, this divine voice calls for prayer. But during the fasting month of Ramadan, it also means that the fasting hours are over and Muslims can eat iftar or their breakfast. In Iran, the Ramadan crescent was sighted on the eve of Sunday, so Sunday was announced as the first day of the holy month.
Ramadan is not just about abstention from eating and drinking. It's a time to purify your soul and contemplate on your mission as a human being. It's an occasion to pray and get closer to God.
This holy month is a perfect time to be the best version of ourselves. We take part in charity works and try to be kind to people around us. It is a month of God, and it is so beautiful.
This is the third year in a row that Muslims observe the fasting month amid the coronavirus pandemic. But this year, COVID restrictions are eased as the pandemic has partly subsided.
It's the first time after more than 2 years that Muslims mark Ramadan without serious worries over the coronavirus. With the majority being vaccinated, the holy month will once again see Muslims getting together for mass religious ceremonies and prayers.
Taking part in congregational prayers is one of the rituals Muslims do before iftar. Last year, such ceremonies were largely curtailed due to the pandemic. This was also the case for the 19th, 21st, and 23rd nights of Ramadan, known as the Nights of Glory, when Muslims congregated mosques to pray and make wishes.
This year, we will host worshippers for the Nights of Glory. During the past 2 years, praying ceremonies were either cancelled or held with social distancing and with a limited participation to curb the pandemic.
Last year and the year before, I caught the virus and couldn't fast the entire month of Ramadan. But thank God, this year everyone is vaccinated and we can observe the holy month together.
Ramadan is the ninth month of the Islamic lunar calendar. Based on this calendar, months begin and end depending on the movement of the moon in its orbit around the earth. And the start of each month depends on the sighting of the new moon the day before. The holy month will end with a major festivity called Eid al-Fitr, or the festival of breaking the fast. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Some 2 million Gazans are observing another holy month of Ramadan under the Israeli blockade for the 16th time in a row. Muslims around the world enjoyed this holy month while people in Gaza struggled to observe it under inhuman conditions. People in the tiny coastal enclave have limited access to food and they are also denied the right to freedom of movement. During this holy month of Ramadan, most Gazans are impoverished as their incomes continue to dwindle because of the crippling Israeli blockade.
The situation in Gaza, especially during the holy month, is very difficult. Poverty and unemployment rates are very high, and people can hardly afford to buy food to prepare their meals and break their fasting.
People usually shop for food items to prepare their iftar meals a few hours before iftar time, which takes place at dusk. Gazans, meanwhile, find it very hard to prepare their fast-breaking iftar meals due to the harsh economic conditions.
Ramadan is a wonderful month, but people are having a hard time because of the Israeli blockade. There is no purchasing power, and most people just walk around the goods while hardly buying anything.
According to UN reports, the majority of people living in the Gaza Strip are receiving some sort of aid to survive. Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed, and poor people have been getting poorer year after year.
Israel work against the international law. The siege is continued at the time we are in the beginning of Ramadan. Blockade means poverty. Blockade means high average of unemployment.
Experts say the Israeli regime has been fueling misery and suffering in the tiny coastal sliver.
Thousands of Gazan families can't afford to buy food to prepare their Ramadan meals amid the dire economic situation. They mainly blame the suffering on the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
As Yemenis are marking the holy month of Ramadan, a new truce was announced by the United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen to help the humanitarian situation in the country. The parties agreed to a nationwide ceasefire for 2 months, in addition to suspending all sorts of aerial attacks from both parties.
The international community has become convinced that this unjustified and barbaric aggression against the Yemeni people must be stopped, and the violations and crimes left by the war are a disgrace to the international community. There are indications of the continuation of the truce, and we hope that it will be the beginning of a complete end to the war and the lifting of the siege on Yemen so that we can confront the humanitarian crisis.
The agreement includes opening Sana'a Airport for 2 flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan only, and allowing Yemen's fuel ships to arrive at Hudaydah Port. However, observers say this agreement is the result of the recent attacks of Yemen's armed forces against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia.
I think, of course, those latest attack against Saudi Arabia and as well in the last few months against United Arab Emirates, it has forced Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates to accept this truce. But it will be really clear in the coming days and week, will they accept this and will they, because there have been many like agreement that has been signed as an example in Stockholm. But still at that time, because Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates were not part of this agreement, they have not signed and they were not mentioned in any of those agreements. That's why they have actually not respecting them.
In addition to the war, Saudi Arabia has been tightening the all-out blockade it imposes on Yemen and has prevented Yemen's fuel ships to enter the country. This has worsened the situation in war-torn Yemen, which is already going through the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the UN.
Despite the tragic humanitarian situation in their country, Yemenis say there has always been light despite all the darkness. They believe the UN brokered agreement may lead to a comprehensive political solution as the Saudi war must come to an end. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A fresh round of violence by the Israeli military has erupted in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin refugee camp, killing 2 Palestinians and wounding 15 others. The army stated that its forces stormed the camp to arrest suspects in connection to Tuesday night's operation in Beni Brak, one of Tel Aviv suburbs, which led to the killing of 5 Israelis and the perpetrator Diyat Hamashi from Yabet town near Jenin. During the funeral procession of the 2 youths in Jenin, mourners vowed to avenge their killing, saying the operation was meant to satisfy the angry settlers.
Israeli forces raided Jenin's refugee camp and the city with large numbers of armored vehicles to kill people in cold blood and to commit more crimes just to satisfy the settlers. It's a criminal regime with its military.
Following Jenin's raid, Israel declared a military operation, dubbed Wave Breaker, to stem what it described as a rising tide of terrorism by Palestinians. In 1 week, Tel Aviv was shocked by 3 lethal series of operations in lands occupied since 1948, leaving 11 Israelis dead.
The current Zionist regime doesn't want an escalation to keep its internal status, despite a call for Israelis to carry arms. At the same time, it gives the settlers free hand along with the military practices.
A 3rd Palestinian man was also shot dead after claims he stabbed and injured an Israeli man with a screwdriver on a bus near the illegal settlement of Efrat in Gush Atzion settlement block between Bethlehem and El Khalil. The Israelis are calling for a military campaign in the occupied West Bank, demanding a painful response. On the other hand, Palestinian resistance groups have vowed to respond to Israeli crimes, saying they have their hand on the trigger. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
In France, the suburbs around cities are known for being poor, immigrant, often Muslim, and for voting for the left. But a new poll shows that the far right has surged in popularity. At 42% of voter intentions, the far right has become as popular as the 3 centrist parties combined. It's now only the poorest areas of the suburbs where the stereotype of the so-called red suburb still holds. Overall, 60% of the suburbs are planning to vote for the 2 political extremes, in a major rejection of the two mainstream parties and President Emmanuel Macron's new party.
These areas feel abandoned by the city centers and the political elite there. So their turn to the political extremes is actually a protest vote. They have a desire to try a different type of politics because they feel that in recent decades, things have only gotten worse for themselves and for France. After decades of alternating power, the mainstream parties are not coming back.
In 2017, the National Front's Marine Le Pen lost in a 66-34% landslide. However, the latest polls show a 53-47% race, which is now within the margin for error. Many Muslims say they are ready to do what was once unthinkable, vote for the far right. Analysts say that suburbs are now voting similar to rural areas and for similar reasons.
10 years ago, people may have voted based on identity issues, but this election is all about class. What we hear voters talking about is inflation, the loss of public services, and unemployment. Mainstream parties don't have a good record on these issues, which have been ignored in this campaign, making these voters even angrier.
The national turn to the right is based on pocketbook issues, but people may also have been persuaded by what's been on the nightly news all year long. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
In his 50-minute televised address on Thursday, Pakistan's embattled Prime Minister Imran Khan came up with serious allegations against the U.S.
They say they're angry with Pakistan. They make this excuse. They say they will forgive Pakistan if Imran Khan loses in the no-trust move. But if the move fails, Pakistan will have to go through a difficult time.
The so-called threat letter was based on the conversation between the Pakistani ambassador in Washington and the U.S. officials. According to the government, U.S. officials were unhappy with Pakistan over its neutral stance on the Russia-Ukraine crisis. The letter then goes on to say that Pakistan would be isolated if the vote of no confidence against Imran Khan failed. This has led the government to conclude that the no-trust move of opposition has the backing of the U.S. Pakistan has summoned a senior diplomat in Islamabad and lodged a formal protest over the controversy.
It's a serious thing, very serious, that pertains to Pakistan's national security. And the onus lies on the Prime Minister Imran Khan that he should bring forth, tell the nation, tell the stakeholders that what is the conspiracy.
Opposition parties have strongly rejected allegations that the U.S. was behind their no-confidence motion. The government also says it has uncovered a plot to assassinate Prime Minister Khan. All this is happening just ahead of the crucial vote of no confidence against the Prime Minister on Sunday.
Prime Minister Khan is linking the vote of no confidence with a foreign conspiracy. Despite losing a majority in the parliament, the embattled Prime Minister insists he would not step down. This means the political battle would go all down to the wire. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
As the conflict in Ukraine grins on, almost 7 million are displaced inside the country and about 4 million people have left their homes in search of shelter abroad. These numbers are increasing on a daily basis. So far, almost 80,000 Ukrainians have arrived in Italy, the majority of whom are women and children, with the most popular destinations being big cities like Milan, Rome and Naples. At the beginning of the war, about 3,000 people were arriving in Italy from Ukraine every day, but now the numbers seem to have slowed. On Thursday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi praised the UN for its contribution to the handling of the refugee crisis.
The UN has been very active in designing humanitarian programs for Ukraine refugees. Bear in mind that while Poland and Romania have received millions of Ukrainians, almost 80,000 refugees have reached Italy so far and about 300,000 have landed in Germany.
Amid the wave of support provided to Ukrainian refugees, aid groups operating in conflict-stricken areas have warned that non-Ukrainians who are trying to flee from Ukraine are facing an